Welcome to this episode of the Level Design Podcast, where we procedurally kick down the doors, perform a perfect three-point superhero landing, and then get into fights in tight spaces with James Parker from Ground Shatter Games. Let's get on with the show. Hello, and welcome back to this episode of the Level Design Podcast. It's us. We're back. I'm Mark Drew. I'm going to be your host, and I'm joined by a wonderful range of hosts with many experiences in the game industry, including Valentina Crisostomo, who is now at Command Studio as a lead designer, director, janitor, and I think we've run out of titles to give you. Isn't that right, Valentina?
Yeah. Hi, everybody. I'm just doing everything, especially the janitor part. That's my main,
right.
That's my main role. And I just clean up the mess. That's what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. And I leave the mess, so fair enough. Yeah. Also, the lovely Jonathan Wilson from Hangar 13, level designer, lead level designer. Are you lead yet?
Because this is an all running gag.
I'm sorry, Jonathan. You must be over the moon with the recent release of Mafia, right?
Yeah, it's been a pleasant surprise for the whole team. It's been really nice to see the fans engaging with the title. So it's definitely been a lot of fun to see some of the people coming across Easter eggs and Twitch streams and stuff growing up right now. So that's been quite interesting to watch.
Oh, nice. That must be really good to see your game being played.
Being enjoyed, I think, is the nicer way to look at it. People not getting frustrated at it, because that's the worry, right? You spend the last couple of months fixing bugs, so you can only see the game is broken. But when it actually goes out and you see people just playing it, it's like, oh, it actually does work.
It'll be all right on the night it goes up.
But it's been really nice.
Also joining me is the lovely Rob McLachlan from the Chinese Room, lead designer there, who are working on top secret things, right?
Absolutely. I can't tell you about any of them. So that's quite short, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good intro. Like, what are you working on? Stuff. And this episode's lovely guest, James Parker from Ground Shatter Games, which is the three-point landing in the intro. And you have the best supercut of three-point landings on your website.
I wrote that screed a long time ago. That's probably due to be updated. It's got references to Saved by the Bell in.
So it's a little bit, I mean, you know, everything comes back around, James. So, you know, but the Saved by the Bell, the remake will be coming soon? I don't know.
They might be the stars of lockdown too.
Oh, God, yeah, no.
Exactly. Thank you for coming on the show. You are responsible for actually some of the most intriguing games I've seen in the last few years. I think I saw Rico in the Games Forum. Was it the Games Forum? London Games Forum?
Yeah, absolutely. We were there at the Games Forum.
And I was like, oh my God, I totally want to have a go at that. But there was too much of a queue. And each time I wanted to go and have a go, I got pulled away by, funny enough, another guest that's been on the show, Tommy Thompson. So like, he was there at the time. And to tie it all back together, Ant Workshop was there with a game that Valentina worked on, which is the
Dead End Job.
Dead End Job.
I wasn't there though, was I?
I don't know. I didn't know.
No, I know I wasn't there. Okay.
Well, to tie it all together even further back, Tony and I and Robble used to work together in our respective first industry jobs.
Oh, wow. So the circle is finally complete. We have brought you all together. But I was watching Rico there, and I guess, James, how would you describe Rico?
The elevator pitch for Rico was kick doors, shoot men. And that's what we kind of pared it down to the smallest possible pitch that we could. It was a co-op cop-based first-person shooter inspired by buddy cop action films, Bad Boys and Lethal Weapon and other such action movie nonsense. And we just really wanted to make something that kind of really focused on co-op play for one thing, because there was tons of cool split screen games that I remembered that wanted to kind of recapture the spirit of, and it wasn't something that the big shooters were really doing.
Right. Because they're not kind of co-op in the sense of buddy cop co-op. They're kind of like, you go shooting one way, somebody else goes shooting somewhere else. Like, you know, I'm thinking Borderlands, right? You're not really cooperating. You're fighting in the same space compared to Rico, which is, we're about to kick this door down. We all have to kill the...
Yeah, we definitely leaned into that as kind of hard as we could. I mean, Borderlands is great, and I think they've kind of flown the flag for that kind of co-op first-person game. There's loads of people say to me that like that was the game that they were playing. That and Payday comes up a lot just because there's kind of thematic elements as well. Mm. But yeah, it was just an opportunity to do something that was a bit fun and a bit kind of mechanics focused and kind of different from the previous stuff we'd done as a studio.
Does remind me of a certain Half-Life mod as well that we used to play at Particle Systems, James, called, was it The Specialists, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was part of a kind of lineage of things. So there was Action Quake first and then
that's it.
Action Half-Life and then The Specialists, the Opera as well, which was the one that our good friend Ross had made some levels for when he first came to work for us. So yeah, these were all mods for various different games that put kind of contemporary weapons into and environments and characters into those games, which had kind of up until that point mostly been kind of fantasy and sci-fi things. And then suddenly there was Gooseman, who went on to make Counter-Strike, had originally done a load of the weapons animations for Action Quake. So all of these kind of action focused mods were a big influence on me, I suppose.
I feel that Rico is it within a Venn diagram circle of games where the player goes horizontal and you are a horizontal man diving through a window sideways.
Well, weirdly, it doesn't have a dive, but it feels like it should.
Ah.
It's got a slide, which is incredibly satisfying. Because you can slide through doors as well, which is practically a foolish thing to do, because all it means is you're in the middle of a room surrounded by bad guys rather than on the edge of a room. But the upside of it is you've done something cool in the meantime. So why not?
You know, A for effort, you know, D for destruction. But the other thing about Rico, which I think is lovely, is it's kind of, is now a little bit overused, but it's got a very specific cell shading style to it, which reminds me of, I wasn't sure if it was a game or a film, or it was both. It's a French one called 13.
Yes, it was a game. It was very influential.
It was a game, right?
They're doing a remake of that was due out this year, but I think it's been moved again, or at least a remaster. But yeah, that did some really nice things with cutaway panels when you got a headshot and in vision, like sound effects, like it was a comic book. So someone would tap on the door and it would say tap, tap, tap on the screen, and really kind of nice little things like that, which had we been a bigger, richer studio, I probably would have ripped off.
You could have had full screen Batman cutaways to pow, zap, and bang.
Yes. That was partly, it was a aesthetic decision. So when we first pitched the game, we were trying to get money for it, and someone from Microsoft went, you have a photorealistic game here and you are never going to compete with the people who are making Call of Duty and whatever it was, Medal of Honor at the time. You should stylize it in some way or other. So we kind of tried out the cel shaded look, and then suddenly it made a whole bunch of extra sense, because it meant we could get away with doing even more over the top things, because it didn't have to have this kind of semblance of realism anymore. It meant we could kind of pull in assets from everywhere and just slap a outline filter on it, and suddenly they were kind of looked in the style of the game as well. That's the kind of pragmatic development side thing, is that suddenly became a way to make everything look coherent without the massive additional work of kind of making everything to a specific style. We just kind of fitted in and around what we had.
Did that also help you with your lovely procedural generation system? Because it meant that you could more simply stick things together?
I'm sure it did. I think the style of the game really helped with just, being able to, I don't know if get away is the right word, but kind of incorporate any elements that we wanted more quickly. But yeah, the procedural generation was an interesting one, because we looked at the kind of usual algorithms and things for making levels, and they're almost entirely focused on dungeons. So they would take a space and they would carve it out, and you would have a room, and then there would be a corridor, and then you'd have another room, which is good for dungeons and is good for gameplay, but doesn't feel like a real space at all. And it reduces the amount of interconnectivity you have as well, to some extent. And that was one of the important things for us, was that because you've got this card game, you want to be able to go into a room from two different sides. Like all the stuff that Rainbow Six Vegas did kind of authored, we wanted to try and do procedurally. So both of you coming in from different sides of the room at the same time, going through a double door together. So we needed spaces that were kind of realistic floor plans. So we had a kind of outside in thing. Our friend Dave Walters made a system which would take a floor plan and then it would split it up into rooms, and it would kind of extrude any extra space to form corridors, and then it would put doors between rooms where it was most appropriate. And that worked kind of really well for creating these spaces that at least felt more like real offices and apartment blocks and things like that.
And I'm thinking that the spaces must also have been adjusted to allow combat in there, because there's a lot of combat going on, right? So the spaces feel, at least from watching trailers and the screenshots, feel bigger than, for example, a normal office space with a table would look like. Was this done on purpose, or is it just something I noticed?
You're absolutely right. It's partly that kind of traditional first-person perspective in games thing where everything has to be a slightly weird scale to feel right, because doors are never quite as high or as wide as they are in games in real life and those kinds of things. So everything is scaled up from that point of view. And also because we wanted it to be fast action and flowing, we made everything kind of necessarily bigger to allow fights to occur within a space.
It's also the bad guy aesthetic, right? It's like, you know, you have the minimalist, big tables, lots of space, exploding barrels. All the bad guys have this, right?
It happens a lot. Like, exaggerating scale for gameplay is quite a common thing to have, especially if you're going for an action-style game where you want that fast-flowing stuff. It would never happen in a real office. You'd just trip over everything. But in something like Rico, you want that, like, freedom of movement, so it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's something that I've noticed with ultra-realistic games is that everything, if there's too much realism, everything's so compact and everything's so tight that you can't actually just move around and shoot and just...
That you're describing the battle between level design and environment art that they have all the time. It needs to be realistic and beautiful. It's like, I agree, but the player is going to bang into every single object you put in here and not actually be able to do
it. Maybe we just remove the collision. Maybe that's what we need to do, just remove collision on like smaller objects and just let the player walk through.
I can already hear all the QA emails coming in now as you walk through all the objects.
Why can I walk through this? I walk through this chair.
When Call of Duty Modern Warfare came out, they did that kind of breaching the townhouse level, which almost made a virtue of being incredibly tight and incredibly realistic space. But it was so tailored to that situation. It was probably only kind of six rooms, but there was so much tension in it. And they were introducing so much at the time that it kind of felt... It was exactly right for what they did. But all the other levels, even when you're using the same kind of breach and clear mechanics, are more traditional game levels in terms of scale and just to make more free-flowing fights work.
I think it's a good contrast to have, though. I guess, like you were saying, there's that more tight experience in, for instance, something like a Call of Duty game, and then they do have the gameplay environments, which are like higher scale in general. And it just gives you contrast as you go throughout. It helps you pierce out the entire experience as well.
James, how did you handle the distribution of enemies in the rooms? Did you have a kind of curve that the enemies would have fewer enemies at the beginning of the level and then they'd build up and also the objectives and things?
That was mostly modulated between levels. Rico's is split up quite hard into different levels in the traditional game sense. So the difficulty scaled as you play through a case. So the premise was you had 24 hours to bring down a crime boss, and you do that by moving through a Slay the Star Spire map of operations, which all had kind of randomized names and difficulties and things like that. So yeah, that would determine the kind of the density of enemies that you would face within a space. And then we also had mechanics where reinforcements would come in after a certain amount of time, or if you did certain objectives, which would then kind of flip it on its head, and you would have people coming in at you rather than you kicking down doors on them.
My favorite moments are when I did enter a very small room, probably horizontally, to find five men standing next to a bed. I wonder quite what they're doing in there.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of screenshots on the Steam community where people have gone into a bathroom, which is a huge room with a single toilet and a towel rail, and then like five gangsters, and they're like, this is suspicious.
We're washing our hands. It's like, you know, you should wash your hands every few minutes, you know. So the proceduralism in Rico, was this like real time? So every time I play it, it's going to be different rooms. It's not that's how you've generated the rooms.
Yeah, right? It was really like super procedural. So there was no pre-authored, pre-constructed sections that were bolted together. It generated the outline of the building, then it generated the outlines of the rooms, and then it placed objects within those rooms. So from a kind of pure level design perspective, it probably has upset all of your brains, because that's not how you should design levels. You shouldn't just let stuff be there. You should make sure that when they go through one door, they can see the next door, and there should be stuff in the sky to draw their attention. Whereas this was like, have at it, have some stuff. But kind of the kind of inherent chaos of the game kind of works, those things work together, because it really helps having absolutely no idea what you're going to face next. So you're not like going into a room thinking, oh, I've seen a kind of variant on this room before, or I know that if I go in this room, then there's going to be a room beyond that. A lot of the time you'd be like, I have to go in this room because I don't know what objectives are in there. So I'm going to do that. And then you back out and go to another room. It helps with the game, and also it kind of hinders it in other areas, because sometimes you end up with quite a lot of boring backtracking.
That approach is being a lot less authored means obviously there's a lot more replayability and you get a lot more variation out of it. Because that was going to be one of my questions. Was this in any way like a tile-based system where you'd built quadrants and you were snapping them together? But yeah, I think your layout, draw the outline, then populate it definitely gives you more results at the end than having pre-built tiles to assemble.
It does, but the question is whether players actually care or know. Yeah. Or whether how much of a difference it makes is kind of something we don't know, because we've got no kind of control experiment. So it's an interesting conundrum that I think for the game, for what it was, and also for the size of the team, we made a multiplayer, multi-platform first person shooter with four people essentially. So we had a bunch of people help us on, like freelancers doing stuff.
I'm going to put a hat on and take the hat off to you.
There's no way we could have done it with, if we had to author even half of the content we did. Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't know the challenge also of not just making rooms but also placing objects and making sure those objects are correctly placed in an environment. Like, for example, you can't have a desk facing the wrong way around and against the wall. So how did you deal with those kind of challenges with object placing in a room?
Yeah, we had quite a complex kind of data system in Unity. So we would create prefabs which had data attached that would say what things, if anything, could be adjacent to them. So there was a sort of kind of tile based system, but on a 1 meter grid essentially. So a desk would take up two tiles, and it would say you can have a chair here and you can have a desk adjacent to it, but you can't have anything else.
And you can have like a laptop on the desk, but you can't have a chair on the desk, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a lot of people think that procedural is like, oh, we just wrote code and it does it automatically. But I think a lot of procedural stuff are also the designer is going and needs to actually think about those things and you put a lot of work in it to be procedurally good. Otherwise, it's just random code, right?
Yeah, definitely. We had that. That was a big kind of technical and creative effort. Was every time we wanted to do a new environment with a new set of objects, we would have to set all of those objects up individually to make sure they could be placed sensibly.
That's the work that I think some people miss. It's like, hey, making games is fun, solving that problem is fun. Now it's like, here's your 400 assets. You have to go through all your prefabs, mark each side saying this can be against a wall, this can't have a chair on it. I don't know, like a table can't have a chair on it. And then just do that for a few weeks. Mm-hmm. Or am I wrong?
No, that is a soul-destroying part of the process.
So after Rico, you're now working on, I mean, you up the style and reduce the colors to fight in tight spaces, right? And like, and again, it's fairly procedural, right? So how would you describe fights in tight spaces? I'm going to call it fits.
That's fine. Fits works. Yeah, so it's a turn-based deck building, action movie, fight, choreography, essentially. So you're play agent 11, you're working for a British spy agency, and you're dropped into various places, bathrooms, marketplaces.
Bathrooms thing going on, huh?
Yeah, always bathrooms. and then you beat up a load of dudes using your deck of cards.
Didn't Mission Impossible give you a trailer for that by basically doing Henry Cavill and
reloading his arms?
He just ripped it off.
That was 100% one of our kind of reading list titles. There's so many good bathroom fights in cinema. It's astonishing.
So with that, that's kind of, another procedural game, but you've really tightened it because you now have obviously tighter spaces. And it just sounds like you're going like, hey, that was too wide. In the previous game, there was too much space. We now need to narrow the do it procedural and narrow it down.
Yeah, and so the levels in FITS are all authored.
Oh, okay. All right.
The game is structurally roguelike in terms of it's a different mission each time you play, so you get different card draws and things like that. But no, the on this one, we could afford, because the team's slightly bigger and because of the space is slightly smaller, to actually author stuff.
Which is, it's kind of interesting. So that has its challenges as well, because now you have to author a whole bunch of assets. But I've only seen some of the videos of FITS, but so how big are the actual environments? Because it's kind of like a quadrant, so you've got little squares and tiles that you can move like chess.
Yeah, yeah. It's essentially a tile-based, grid-based game, kind of at least partly inspired by Into the Breach. So that was one of the original kind of touch points. So that operates on an 8x8 grid most of the time. And I was thinking that would be our kind of top size level. But I think in reality, I think we don't have any levels that are actually 8x8 playable tiles. We might go up to kind of 8x3 or 6x6. And those tiles are a meter square. So like we're dealing with really specifically tight spaces.
And for this project, it wasn't really necessary to have a bigger space because you're not actually controlling a first-person character. Like you're playing with cards, basically, right? So that is handled by in that way. You don't need the actual space, right?
Yes, absolutely. So the idea was to make every move and attack count every turn. So it was always moving forward, and kind of the combat should be the star. And the reason why you can move around is so you can use the environment as a weapon. So if you get someone against an edge, you can smack their head against it, or you can kick them out of a door or over a bar, or all of those different things that kind of action movie tropes of ways of dispatching enemies quickly. The bigger the space gets, the harder it gets to control the fight, both from an authorship point of view and from a player's perspective. So it was kind of important to get that right quite early on. And we still, every time we change how the game works, there's a big cascade effect of balancing to do, because there's now 120 different cards that have different properties and a bunch of different enemies that do different stuff and a bunch of these different levels. So we're kind of constantly kind of revising all of those assumptions that we've had.
I seem to remember an interview with Justin Marr about Into the Breach, where they said that making the game was almost the easy part, but making the UI and getting people to understand how to play the game was the thing that took almost all the time. Is that something that has been a challenge?
Yes, 100%. Conveying what's going to happen when you play a card, when the effects of that card can be, you do some damage, that's obvious. Also, you can move yourself. Also, you can move the target. Also, you can knock the target down. Also, you can stun them. Also, you can magic up some energy from somewhere. You can, all of these different things. We've got an incredibly flexible and powerful card game system, which is exactly what you need for a deck building game. We also have to fit that within a physical space-based, tile-based game where you can convey all that information at the same time. So yeah, that is, and continues to be a massive kind of design challenge.
With all the different permutations of cards as well, especially changing like every time you play a level, like how did you go about approaching thinking about balancing a level and things like that in this game? Was there like a minimum and a minimum and max deck that you could compare each level against, or did you have to take a like completely different approach to that?
We do that to some extent. So what we found with the levels was, because we're only dealing with a small number of tiles, ultimately, the amount of variation is fairly limited. So it generally comes down to density of enemies and what those enemies are and how far they can move. And that changes quite a lot over the course of the game. But the benefit of that is it means we can change how the levels are structured slightly over the course of the game as well, so we can accommodate, as much as anything, we're accommodating the enemies, and then the deck is balanced against those enemies rather than specifically against the levels.
So FITS is still in production. You're coming towards the end of production. How long have you been developing this game for?
Much longer than originally intended.
Isn't that always the case?
Yes, a year and a half now, I think.
And half of that, you've had 2020 in the way, like have you always been remote? Are you all now working remotely? Or
no, we were very happily all working together in the Bristol Games Hub where we have an office. No, when the pando hit, we all up sticks and went to our respective homes. So that was quite a big change for us. Everyone's coped very well. Yeah, so we have remote meetings via Discord and chat, and you know, just try and get on with it really. And now we've had new employees join over the last 6 months, so that they're kind of coming in to an entirely remote scenario, which may or may not change at any time. So it's just kind of lucky to have the team that I've got, who are all very talented and driven and capable of working on their own and with other people.
I mean, it's always good to launch into that. I've noticed that a lot of like established teams are great to join because then they've got a patter and a pattern of working that. But you know what I mean? They've got like a way of talking to each other and that you can understand the nuance. Then bringing new people on board is kind of like trying to make them understand that nuance of working with each other. But what are the challenges now of getting Fitz out?
The weird new challenges are stuff like the fact that I live a bit in the countryside, so my broadband is awful. So the turnaround between a build being done, which is much quicker than it was for Rico. We had a big unwieldy project for Rico, so build would take ages and ages. But then to copy it onto my machine would take almost no time. And now the build's really quick, but then it has to be uploaded, and then I have to download it on rural broadband. And it takes an hour before I can try out a new thing. So it's kind of same problems, but in different configurations.
Right. I mean, that now that the build's faster, the download's slower, it's the same thing, all right? Just yeah. Just pretend it's the same thing. No, but it's good that it's going to go out. It's going to be out on Steam and usual stores, or are you going out on Steam, or are you going Epic?
I think I'm not allowed to say. Usual stores the best thing to say.
As your local purveyor of quality games.
The official line is we haven't confirmed platforms. Wishlist on Steam, though. Definitely wishlist on Steam.
So Fitz, that's fight in tight spaces. Was that deliberate? So it sounds like Fitz, or that was just accidental?
It's a happy accident, I would say. Yeah. Because also it sort of abbreviates to fights as well. So it's kind of, it's everything is convenient. It was like, it was one of the first games that I've made where the title was in and locked in really early on.
Well, it's a good title, right? It's like a...
You should have named it Fights in Super Tight Spaces, then it will have been Fists. Yeah. Oh,
now you come up with it.
James.
No, this is, it looks like a super interesting game, especially when there's been a massive, and by the way, I'm not saying they're the same at all, but there's been a massive popularity in games like John Wick Hex, and this kind of, I'm an old XCOM lover, right? I love my Enemy Unknown and my XCOM and these kind of tile-based games. So every time I see like that kind of strategy game, I'm like, this is great, and there's not enough of them. Or maybe there are, but they're all to do with wizards and stuff, which I'm not that much into. But maybe I'm just showing my colors here. But this is like totally my jam. This is like, right, I can lock my fists, you know, cock my fists, and then get into a little fight with, you know, with
some bad dudes,
spend and with some bad dudes, and make sure that I can do them.
Yeah, I'm cut from a similar cloth. I'm like, I don't like wizards and elves and all that nonsense. So I'm kind of restricted. If I want to play a fantasy game or a deck builder, then I'm very limited in kind of the approaches that I can take for that as a player.
Right, because it's that and what is it, League of Legends, I guess, a kind of
Hearthstone,
real-time RTS, Hearthstone and those kind of, I mean, like, I'm the wrong
person. Slay the Spire.
Oh, okay, you know them.
You got Darkest Dungeon.
He's got them like all listed in front of him because he plays all of them.
James, it strikes me that there's a kind of fundamental philosophical difference between like XCOM and this sort of new breed of things like Into the Breach and Fitz, where it's almost deterministic. So you know what's going to happen. If you do certain things in a certain order, then you're going to get the same result. Whereas any XCOM player will tell you that a 95% chance of killing of an alien that's about to rip your head off is basically you're going to miss. Did you consider any sort of random chance factor in Fitz?
We didn't really. I think because, at least partly because we were, our influences were Into the Breach and Slay the Spire, both of which kind of eschew randomness kind of as much as they can. The random factor in a deck building game is what cards you get dealt in any one hand, and also what cards you build your deck with between fights. So adding a kind of dice roll onto that seems sort of a bit impure. And I think there seems to be a kind of schism in board games as well between, like you say, the very deterministic things and stuff that is very kind of traditional games, which are all about rolling tons and tons of dice and counting up the spots and seeing who wins. It's kind of like you seem to have to make one of those choices now rather than kind of throwing it all in.
That's true, because then you've got this idea that if you failed, it's your own fault for having chosen your wrong equipment, right? And especially in a fighting game, I'm going to say Fizz is a fighting game in a way, you know, not a real-time fighting game. And I mean that with all due respect, it looks like, but it's, if your failure is not because you missed the punch, it's because you didn't use the right powers at the same time, rather than, hey, you had a 98% chance of killing that bad guy.
You didn't get the optimum solution, firstly. You have the deck in front of you. You didn't clear the right hand of cards. So it does come down to your strategy.
Yeah, we kind of, at times, kind of at its best, it's like a puzzle game. It's like there is a layout of enemies. You are in a position. You have this set of cards. There is going to be an optimum solution. It's up to you to find it. And because it's turn-based, you have all of the time in the world to make those choices. And that's the interesting thing about watching people play from my point of view, is if I'm watching a YouTuber pick it up for the first time and they're kind of working their way through the game, then I will see avenues that they haven't taken. And then they'll be frustrated when they've lost. And it's hopefully we can convey to those people that it's them who's failed themselves rather than that the game has failed them. Because it's quite easy to get frustrated and think, well, that was an impossible situation. Whereas someone else would look at it and go, it was an impossible situation, mate. You screwed up. So I don't want to, it'd be nice to have a thing that went, could have done it this way, but I think that might be a bit too smug and irritating.
Yeah, you could have done it, but now you did.
In the game, when you're playing the levels, do you have to use all the cards you're dealt to win? Or can you, like we were talking about optimum solutions, could you use a configuration of cards and have cards left over?
Yeah, you can you end the turn and it discards the rest of your cards. So you can sometimes get injuries, which will do you damage if you don't discard them, or cards that are extra powerful, but you have negative consequences to not using them. But in general, it's quite kind of generous and flexible with how you play. But I think one of the things that the theme does, and what I wanted to do, was kind of open up that style of game to potentially a wider audience, people who wouldn't normally pick up a strategy game, certainly wouldn't pick up a deck building game, but by going, look, this is a game about doing cool action movie stuff and having fights, then hopefully that brings in a set of people who like us might be turned off by wizards, but might be more interested in something that feels like a Mission Impossible film. So the game is tough. I mean, we've tuned it to a bunch of Discord players, like beta testers, who've been really good at providing feedback, but kind of ramping up the difficulty as we go. So when people get into the game, they feel cool from the get-go. So we give them quite a generous deck of starting cards, just so there's a bunch of cool moves that they can do right at the beginning, and then they'll successfully beat up some sets of bad guys. And then by then, hopefully they'll be into it enough to kind of engage more with some of the deeper complexities of it. We've already seen that when we did the autumn demo event on Steam at the start of this month, and some people picked it up and played it on YouTube who had seen the key art and thought, oh, this is a cool fighting game, and had no idea of the genre. But when they got into it, they were having a whale of time. Mm-hmm. They were lovable idiots, but they were really enjoying it. And that's kind of all you can ask for.
I mean, and this is one of the things about, I think that we can go a whole episode about putting your game on Steam and what are the key art that you have to publish and what are the decisions about selling your game with specific art. I mean, this is something that Valentina and I are talking about at the moment. But if you think of Gone Home, for example, that has a very iconic art at the front that kind of tells you what the game is about or insinuates what the game is about, that can draw the right type of people into it that would like it. And I realize that there's a slight switcheroo in some of this, but with Fizz, the monochromatic look
I remember it very well, you know, because I can just see it working. You have the awesome backflips in some of the videos and stuff like that. So it's not that it does.
Yeah, very unique.
Yeah, it's very unique. And it's not that it does exactly what it says on the tin type thing, but it's more like, you know, oh, I think I know what I'm going to get out of this.
Yeah, it's deliberately striking. It's kind of both from a marketing perspective, because you need to stand out these days, but also from a kind of, we want it to be stylish. We want it to feel like, you know, the opening titles to Casino Royale. We've kind of been compared with that, because that's got that kind of monochrome fight scene type thing going on, like all of those things. It evokes an idea that kind of people, hopefully our audience, will engage with. So it has benefits across the board. And also, again, pragmatically, it means we can build a lot more characters a lot more quickly, because they don't need to be fully textured. They're kind of authored and textured in a very specific way that kind of emphasizes those points. So it involves quite a lot of artistry, but it doesn't necessarily involve quite the same amount of manpower.
Did the game start out with these exact colors from the beginning, or did you have something else entirely?
The earliest pitch we did using Ricoh assets. So we had kind of cel-shaded background and characters from that game, but with a whole bunch of our own kind of combat animations in. But that was as much as anything, because that was what we had. We did a fair amount of kind of trial and error working out the look for it. And this was kind of the most extreme example, but it worked. So we stuck with it. And yeah, we tried a few different things color scheme wise, but it always made sense to have kind of brightly colored enemies and quite kind of saturated white backgrounds, partly to evoke the spirit of Mission Impossible's bathroom fight, and partly because it kind of makes things easier to see when clarity is already a difficult thing in terms of the UI and the UX, then removing any potential difficulties that we'd have if everything was realistic and there was stuff all over the floors and all over the walls that would potentially get in the way of that. It's really nice to have the contrast between the background and the UI elements, and between the UI elements and the players.
Mm-hmm. And come on, a guy in a bathroom, the bad guys are red, the bathroom's white, and he's wearing a tuxedo, so he has to be in black, right?
Oh, and blood sprays everywhere, and that looks really good.
Right. Yeah.
Odd floors.
Oh, yeah. That's a nice contrast. Are you able to turn off the blood?
You are, but why would you?
I don't know. There's people who apparently don't like that. So.
You'd have to have a game mode where it's a bit like the unfinished swan, where you only ever see the actual
you reveal
world through
the
blood spatters. Go all over it.
Yeah. Ooh, that'd be cool. Imagine you actually paint the room with their blood, and then you can see it in red.
Next time I might up the Peggy rating.
just slightly.
That's a different game. That's the Halloween edition.
Where, James, do you think things are going in terms of the sort of like Geister games? Because I ask this question because you've been very interested in co-op for a long time, and you've made and released lots of co-op games, some couch co-op, some online co-op. And then we've got the kind of zeitgeist mega hits like Among Us and Fall Guys. Where do you think the industry's heading in terms of how these hits are appearing?
I've kind of followed a trajectory that is kind of very kind of personal to me, I suppose, that like Grand Shadow's first game was Skyscrapers, which was really influenced by calling up arcade games, the sorts of things that I played as a kind of 8, 9, 10 year old in Tynmouth. Like proper old school stuff. And then Ricoh was very influenced by Doom, playing Doom co-op and making levels for Quake and playing Action Quake and things like that. So, and then Fitch was influenced by stuff that I've been playing more recently. So I'm probably a poor soothsayer when it comes to industry trends.
And it's a massive industry in a way. Is the trend is at what level, you know, at AAA level? Well, there's big franchises out there that will do what they're going to do. You know, like Call of Duty is going to Call of Duty, right? It's going to refine that sports gameplay.
I wonder if the co-op aspect is something that is a kind of cyclical thing that comes through the industry, because we've had things like Army of Two and other big budget things that have tried to do co-op and with varying levels of success. But that sort of that buddy cop movie feeling to a game I think that that's, is that something that you've been interested in?
Definitely for me, it was a potentially untapped market. It was more going against the kind of prevailing options. Like, and even things like Call of Duty, right, which have co-op in zombies mode, which is often really good. It was, you sometimes feel a bit shortchanged that you can't play the whole campaign in co-op. So certainly some of my fondest gaming memories of, like you say, things like Army of Two and Kane and Lynch, which are games that are elevated when you play them in co-op beyond kind of their initial nature. And the same is true of Rico. It's a solid game, but it's, you just have a magnitude more fun if you're playing it co-op. And we see that all the time where reviewers are like, YouTubers who are playing with a mate absolutely love it and they have stupid fun time. And that's not because of the game, that's because they're playing something with their friends. And that's what makes Among Us fun, is because generally you're playing it with people you know and you're getting up to mischief. And then it doesn't matter that it's a kind of weird low budget out of nowhere hit. It's because it facilitates some people having a really good time together.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people confuse multiplayer and co-op, because multiplayer doesn't mean that you cooperate. You just mean you play with a lot of people, your friends, and the social aspect makes it fun. But co-op, it means you have to rely on each other, or you help out each other, or there's the gameplay takes that into consideration. And I think a lot of games just sell it as co-op, whereas the true case is multiplayer.
Or like this, I like to call it cheap AI. And you know, why write it when you can get a whole bunch of people to be it?
Although then you have to do all the multiplayer code,
which is a whole other kind of worms.
Press the multiplayer button.
Well done, James, for creating a multiplayer game in Unity. That's extremely good.
Yeah.
Oof.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you. We hope to have you back on again and really talk about your experiences making Reservoir Dogs and then American Idol and then SpongeBob SquarePants, because those are the real games we needed to talk about.
And Bionicle.
Bionicle. We didn't touch that you worked on Bionicle,
that
can
be its own episode, the Bionicle episode.
Right, we'll do the Bionicle.
Very good reviews.
We could do an oral history of Bionicle.
Right.
With just the two of us.
Yeah, you're on. That's going to be our 15-hour episode coming next year. But James, if people want to get hold of you, ask you more about Rico and obviously Wishlist, Fighting Tight Spaces, where can they shout, tweet?
That's probably best to find me on Twitter at GamesWriting or at GrandShatter or at FightsGame, depending on which aspects of my self, business, or products they're interested in. And then you can follow links out of those to other popular websites.
Fantastic. We're going to put links to all your games and your contacts in the show notes. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. It was excellent.
And thank you, my lovely co-hosts. And with that, I bid you farewell. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Level Design Podcast has been a Command Studio production. Our editor is Matthew Lever, and this episode has been produced by Bridie Rose.